Very good. So when I was thinking about this presentation, it reminded me of my first year as a graduate student, where I wanted to be a theorist. So I walked into Tina Veltman's office and said, I want to be a theorist. So he talked to me for about 5 or 10 minutes, and he says, you know what? You're not smart enough to be a theorist. Why don't you be an experimenter and have a great life? So that's what I did. I've had a great life. Those of you who know Tina Veltman, he's probably had that same conversation with some of you in this room. That was my step into theoretical physics. So, as has been mentioned by Joanne, there's been a tremendous activity in the snowmass experience, which is very different in the past, and there's many meetings that have been going on. There was the meeting at SLAC that was referred to for neutrino physics, but also the Cosmic Frontier. There's been many, many other meetings that I'm going to refer to that have contributed materials here leading up to this penultimate snowmass on the Mississippi. I'm sure this violates the DOE's vision of having a lower cost affair, but it's certainly a different experience than the previous snowmass. The Intensity Frontier is a very vibrant community. There's many experiments, lots of dreams and ambitions, some of them shown here. This is not meant to be an exhaustive collage. In addition to experiments, there's this concept of facilities. And in DOE speak, that is something that's north of $100 million in DOE accounting. Some of you know that in the last couple of months, there's been an exercise in each office of the Office of Science, and in the Higher Energy Physics Office, there was an activity to characterize the different facilities. And LB&E has characterized, the full scope of LB&E was characterized as absolutely central to the field, but stage one is only important. And that tension has generated a lot of energy in the field that we'll no doubt talk about. UDE is an experiment, muon to electron coherent conversion, described as absolutely central. Project X, the accelerator, was described as absolutely central. And NewStorm was not characterized because it is an initiative to go after some of the anomalies around the EEV scale and neutrino mixing, which may point to sterile neutrinos. The evidence is kind of thin in my estimation, I would say. And so the jury's a bit out as to what the right approach is and as to whether those technologies required for a muon storage ring in the future is also a jury is still out. So the subpanel concluded without prejudice that there's not enough information today to characterize NewStorm. So this is a slide that I got from my communication mentor, Hitoshi Murayama, many of you know, that illustrates an unhealthy relationship between theorists and experimenters. We're the little dog down here on the end of the leash. Okay. Yeah, no, well, pick it. So I think you'll all agree, again from Hitoshi, that this is the kind of relationship we want to have between experimenters and theorists, where there's a lot of challenge from the data, from the experimental community, the LHC, neutrinos, rare processes. This is obviously an intensity frontier-centric slide. And a message from this slide is that I'm often asked, what is the killer application in the intensity frontier? Is it LB&E? Is it MUDE? What's the killer app? And the answer is that there isn't one. There is no silver bullet experiment, and the science requires multiple probes. And it's a similar question if I were to ask those people who built the CMS detector or the Atlas detector, which subdetector in CMS or Atlas is the killer app? Is it the silicon tracker? Important, obviously, but it was secondary in the discovery of H to gamma gamma, as was the calorimeter, and critical in the discovery of H to gamma gamma, but not as critically important in some of the B tagging. So the genius of CMS and Atlas and the energy frontier is that we've come together technologically to build a device and enormous collaborations that can work together to, in fact, make a major discovery of our field, as Michael mentioned. So with respect to talking about experiments, I'm going to use the structure that Joanne put up a bit earlier about the working groups of the summer study, quark flavor physics, charged lepton processes, neutrinos, baryon number violation, new light weakly coupled particles, and how nucleons, nuclein atoms touch our science. And this is the last category is important because it's outside of higher energy physics, and there are some architectural issues there. So let me just talk about quark flavor physics. These are summary slides from Jack Ritchie, one of the conveners at the Intensity Frontier All Hands meeting at Argonne a couple of weeks ago. So it's a broad program worldwide, and what's shown in the box here are experiments that are proposed in the United States. So I want to focus on those and what their scientific impact can be. As Joanne mentioned, Kata Pinedu-Bahr is a very powerful probe. It's in flavor physics, it's quite interesting because it has a single effective operator, and the theory prediction is quite under control and will be at the few percent level into the future. So the sensitivity of that single effective operator to the lambda scale on the t-shirt that Joanne had illustrated is shown here. And so you can see that in quark flavor physics, there's already, and this is of course the flavor problem, is that there's already sensitivity at the 100 TeV scale, and the value added to the field of Kata Pinedu-Bahr is extending that sensitivity by nearly an order of magnitude. In addition to extending that roughly by an order of magnitude, there's substantial model discrimination power in Kata Pinedu-Bahr, particularly in warped extra dimensions, which we may hear about later in this meeting. The history of these experiments, K plus to pi plus nu nu bar, has been discovered. There's seven events that have been observed at Brookhaven. How you do this experiment is you make a lot of kaons and you stop them in a target. So it's a center of mass detector. It's like CMS or Atlas, that you have the physics event coming from a central point. And over the decades, that technique has been perfected to observe seven events. There's a proposal at Fermilab, the scientific stage one approval, to extend the sensitivity of that experiment to 1,000 events. So a factor of 100 times the statistics of the original observation. Fittingly, this experiment plans to use the infrastructure of the CDF detector to put the entire detector inside of the CDF magnet, since it's a center of mass experiment, as I mentioned. One of the ambitions in the future would be to measure K long to pi zero nu nu bar to comparable precision on the order of 1,000 events. This is one of the hardest experiments in experimental particle physics. It's been generously described as nothing in and nothing out. You have a neutral hadron coming in that decays into two photons. The rate is expected to be a few times 10 to the minus 11. And so one of the challenges for our detector builders is to build the perfect electromagnetic calorimeter that can detect those two photons, point them back to a vertex, measure their time to within 10 picoseconds, that's about 1 or 2 millimeters of movement in space, and measure their energy to the few percent. So this is like Fermi glass on steroids. It's that technology, but taken to the next level. So we cannot do this experiment today. We probably can't do this experiment 10 years from now. It requires critical detector R&D and support for that detector R&D to do this experiment. There's great synergy with some of these techniques and the LHC detector upgrades for next generation calorimetry. Some of the other physical parameters one can mention that have BSM sensitivity. Through that, we can come back to that if there's questions. The message from SNOMAS for quark flavor physics is that the quark flavor physics probes far above scale. There's an opportunity today, using its existing infrastructure at Fermilab, to mount a world-leading experiment in K plus to pi plus nu nu bar, and ultimately Project X at Fermilab will lead the way for decades to come into that future. Let me turn now to the next working group, charged lepton processes, and talk about the status of charged lepton flavor violation. We, of course, know that there's lepton flavor violation in neutrino mixing. This is charged lepton flavor violation, which again has strong model discriminating power. It's been searched for many decades. The current state of the art, as you can see, is between 10 to the minus 13 and less than that, with the goals of the mu to e experiment at Fermilab in the range of 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 17. So how does that work? Where does that incredibly small branching fraction that you've heard about, 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 17, come from? That's much, much less than anything else you've ever heard about in flavor physics. And it works because the mu minus is captured on an atomic in an atom, so that the normal radius of an electron is about 440 fermis from the nucleus. When the mu minus is captured and cascades down to the nucleus, it's orbiting 20 fermis within the nucleus. There's a large overlap of that S wave in the final 1s state with the nucleus. So it's a tremendous overlap of the wave functions with the quarks in the nuclei. And this is an effective luminosity enhancer by about six orders of magnitude. And that's the trick to get to these much, much higher sensitivities, is that you park these muons right on top of the quarks. Leads to effectively much, much higher luminosity. The MUTE experiment at Fermilab, as the goal is to discover the coherent conversion of a muon in a 1s orbit of a nucleus interacting with the quarks through a BSM process to a coherent electron conversion. The sensitivity, as I mentioned, 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 17, four orders of magnitude better than what's been done before, requires a large number of muons, obviously, and controlling the background to a very low level. The sensitivity to mass scales, this is some work that's been done by Andre, which has been very useful in communicating the mass scale sensitivity as a function of physics model, whether it is a dipole term, so there's a loop process where Susie can contribute, for example, or a contact term, where which are other sources of BSM that's characterized by this kappa parameter. And you can see that the mass scales that are probed are between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4th TeV. This is just some project ease about how that experiment is coming along, give you a sense of scale as to how long a technically driven project takes in high energy physics. There's no money problem for mu to E, to first order, in high energy physics. So you might ask, how long does it take to build a major experiment in high energy physics? This is how long it takes. There is no fast track. It's important to have that scale in your mind. So in the case of mu to E making a discovery, there's a clear path towards scientifically, one wants to then measure the rate on other nuclei rather than aluminum, which is what we'll be started with. And the motivation for that is that capturing the muons in other nuclei, as you can see in the upper right-hand plot, there are factors of two or three in the rate that are induced by other models, whether it's vector terms, whether the BSM is vector-driven or scalar-driven, et cetera. So choosing different stopping nuclei is a way to provide discrimination power in addition to the initial run with the aluminum nucleus. So, and if mu to E does not see a signal at that sensitivity, then the next step in Project X will increase the sensitivity of the experiment by a factor of 10 and a factor of 100, and a corresponding energy scale that goes roughly by the fourth root of that. So the relationship between the energy scale increase in energy scale sensitivity and branching fraction increase is the fourth root. So we have to increase the sensitivity by a factor of 10,000 to go from 1 TeV or 10 TeV, depending on the process studied. So that's the price you pay in taking the step in direct reach and energy scale. Let's turn now to neutrinos. This is the last slide from Grossman's presentation at the all-hands meeting. BSM physics has been discovered, we all know that, now in neutrino mass. And so Yuval's quote from that meeting in a summary slide is that once you find an entrance to new physics that you've discovered, you want to push on that as hard as you can. It's a very vibrant field. There's not time to go through all the different neutrino experiments that are out there, but I do want to talk about the long baseline oscillation experiment and, of course, double beta decay, and then talk a little bit about the texture for smaller experiments that should exist in the field. Let me start first with next generation double beta decay. So what's the scientific motivation? The currently running and approved experiments searching for double beta decay will just start to touch the top of the inverted neutrino hierarchy band. So a good goal for this field would be for the next generation, which is the snowmass era that we're talking about, to cover the sensitivity of the inverted hierarchy. That's a very good goal that's embraced and well-motivated for next generation double beta decay experiments. They're hard experiments. They're going quite well at the moment. There's several experiments that are underway. There's some very good ideas out there. There are challenges for next generation experiments. Some of the challenges, for example, for the Camlan Zen, is that they have a contamination from particular isotopes of silver that were produced in Fukushima. So you're at that level of sensitivity where you have to where the challenges are just enormous, but the community is very strong, and there are some good ideas to in fact cover that band of the inverted hierarchy, which is the goal for the double beta decay. And again, why do we want to do that? We want to do that because we want to over-constrain the model. It's not because we want to determine the hierarchy and turn off the NOVA experiment at Fermilab. What we're trying to do is to measure the hierarchy in multiple and different ways and look for consistency and over-constrain the models. That's the whole point. There are theory issues for double beta decay. It's very important to continue support for nuclear theory on predicting these matrix elements. Remember, of course, what we're measuring is a rate of double beta decay, and it's very important for us to understand what sources of background are and what the anticipated rate would be to connect it to a corresponding energy scale. There's complications in life in that double beta decay research program is supported. The vision is that it's supported by the Office of Nuclear Physics in the Department of Energy. There's historical reasons why there's some support for the EXO experiment and the Office of High Energy Physics. And so this is one of these cases where there's boundary issues, and one of the messages from SNOMAS, and particularly from the theoretical community, to the agencies is let's work together to try to get through these stovepiping issues and get the agencies to work together. And we should work as a community to help the agencies understand where the synergies are between the different agencies and the research program. Let me turn now to the long baseline neutrino experiment, LBNE, which is a high power proton source at Fermilab that makes a neutrino beam, high precision measurement of the neutrino interaction, the so-called NIR detector, and then a large liquid argon detector and LEED, South Dakota, buried underneath Crazy Horse or thereabouts. So what is LBNE? As I mentioned, it's a 700 kilowatt proton beam capable to be upgraded in a factor of 3 in beam power and hence neutrino flux to 2.3 megawatts near detector. An optimal 1,300 kilometer baseline to the, from Fermilab to the Sanford Underground Research Facility, SURF. So how do we know that that's optimal? What's plotted here is the fraction of CP, is the sensitivity to the mass hierarchy on the left for the fraction of possible CP values. And you can see that 1,300 kilometers essentially saturates the sensitivity. As you go farther away, you become more sensitive to the mass hierarchy because it's a matter of fact. But if you go too far, you start losing neutrinos. And so there's an optimum. Likewise, in the case of CP violation, there is an optimum. So 1,300 kilometers is a well-chosen distance from the proton source to the laboratory. The full vision of LBNE is the 34 kiloton liquid argon TPC buried at depth, which enables a whole portfolio of underground science. There's a conceptual design, which is technically quite robust. Interestingly, this technology has been driven by advances in the liquefied natural gas industry, which has been an interesting connection. And that since it's been in the news lately, but when you think about 34 kilotons of liquid argon underground or on any surface, how can you possibly do that? But there are vessels that are coursing the oceans right now and parked at ports, maybe even Port of Los Angeles. I don't know what the rules are there, but the technology to store massive amounts of cryogenic liquids cheaply has been mastered. We didn't pay for it in high energy physics. It's an opportunity for us to take advantage of it. This follows exactly what Steve was talking about in Dyson's remarks, that technology drives the field forward. And that's why we're interested in these liquid argon technologies. There's stress in the field associated with LBNE, of course. and that it's not an inexpensive experiment, which has led to the strategy of staging the experiments with a particular funding cap that I think many people know, on the order of $870 million. And the first, so that has led to a particular scope of a 10 kiloton detector on the surface, which does not support the research goals of the underground science, in particular nucleon decay. That has been a source of frustration for the field. Recently, the collaboration has identified the goal of the first phase is to, in fact, reach a mass greater than 10 kilotons and place the detector underground. That is not what the DOE project says today. So the way that that is going to be done, the strategy of the collaboration is to pursue a greater involvement of international collaboration. And there's been a substantial outreach in the last few months associated with that. The European strategy statement that came out recently is an important entree into that discussion. And there are serious discussions between Europe and the U.S. in particular on contributions to realizing this vision of getting the experiment underground. What does it cost? I caution you, when you think about cost, what's very important, just when you do your calculations, you have to know what the metric is. So when you talk about cost, know what the metric is. And if you don't, you don't know what you're talking about. So that there's a total project cost in the DOE, which is an integral of the associated effort and indirect cost associated with that effort. And so it's important to have the same metric when you're talking. So these are some costs for your benefit to understand what some of those stages cost. So to place the detector underground in DOE total project cost accounting is on the order of $140 million. So is LBNE asking CERN for $100 million to put the detector underground to pay for the concrete? The answer, of course, is no. So a more appropriate strategy is that the U.S. Bear the burden of the infrastructure to put the experiment underground, all the concrete, and, for example, a European consortium come in and build and supply a 20 or 30 kiloton liquid argon detector underground. CERN does this. So CERN is, what does CERN do? CERN provides an accelerator. The CMS and Atlas detectors, of course, they had contributions from CERN, but those were large international collaborations that delivered those detectors. We ought to have the same vision in the United States, that Fermilab, like CERN, provide the beam, provide the concrete to put the detectors underground, and we welcome the broader international community to put in high-power detectors underground. That is the strategy. Now, nevertheless, I must say that the 10 kiloton detector on the surface for LBNE has substantial sensitivity for CP violation, measuring CP violation. We don't make these measurements in a vacuum. There's other experiments going on. There's the NOVA experiment, there's T2K in Japan, and then the combined sensitivity of all these measurements together has a 1 sigma resolution on the order of 20 to 30 degrees, as you can see, and greater than 3 sigma discovery sensitivity for a fair fraction of CP violation. We all recognize in the field that that's not enough. So to get enough, it takes more beam power. So the strategy of LBNE, which goes back to the original P5 exercise that Steve alluded to, is to pursue a large underground detector with a high power proton source. So if we realize that in the instance of Project X and LBNE, you can see that we'll have greater than 5 sigma sensitivity for a wide range of CP violating parameters. Come back to that in detail if there's questions. We talked about the underground science. Nucleon decay, of course, is highly motivated. Ed Curran said that he would give me a bottle of wine if we could identify from which Nobel lecture this diagram came from. And as far as I know, no one's answered it yet. So if you have an answer, we can maybe work out a deal. So what's the future look like for nucleon decay? The golden mode of V plus pi zero has future sensitivity. There's been a lot of discussion about neutrino K plus because of its strong relationship to SUSY signals. The attraction of LBNE is that the efficiency for that signal, as you can see in liquid argon with respect to water, is much, much more efficient. It's about a factor of 5 in gain in efficiency. Delta B equals 2 NN bar oscillations. It's background limited with water techniques. And there's an opportunity that with free neutrons that you'll see where we can increase that sensitivity. Here's the projection in sensitivity approaching 10 and exceeding 10 to the 35 years, as you can see. I want to mention this idea of a neutron anti-neutron oscillation, free neutron in space. This was successfully mounted at the ILL in Europe in the 90s, background-free experiment. There's an idea to push that ahead with Project X to increase the sensitivity to delta B equals 2 by a factor of 1,000. And by a factor of 50 with respect to super K we'll ever get since it's background limited. Let me talk down to new light weakly coupled particles. There's great opportunity at Jefferson Lab to look for particles that couple rather weakly to photons. Likewise at Project X with proton fixed target beams. Here's a sensitivity space of alpha prime with respect to alpha as a function of the mass of the particle, and there's quite substantial sensitivity from future experiments. This is, of course, quite highly motivated by some recent ideas. Let me turn now to something that has been described as nuclear physics, but it's electric dipole moments, which, of course, is central to our field. EDM research worldwide, there's about 500 researchers worldwide pursuing various EDMs. The approach has been to look for EDMs in nucleons, nuclei, and electrons. The limits are shown here, several orders of magnitude above the standard model. As you all know, that these are very strong arbiters against various SUSY models, which I'm sure has been a great sense of frustration for you. But this is a place where we can move forward and test those models with great vigor. There's a new idea that's come out in the field. The EDM of a proton, which if you think for a second is a little hard to do because it's a charged particle. How do you measure an EDM? You put it in a large electric field. What happens to a proton if you put it in a large electric field? It accelerates. So there's a concept that's been developed and reviewed that looks quite promising that would likewise be mounted at Project X. This field is wonderful. I was just in this lab a couple of weeks ago at Seattle, and it's literally tabletop, and it's just such a beautiful experiment, and it's ruling the field right now. There's an idea that next generation experiments in atomic EDM can use octopole deformations that can exist, that have been predicted to exist in particular isotopes, such as radium-225 that has an octopole deformation, which can enhance a native EDM by up to a factor of 1,000. These enhancement factors are shown there in the lower right. And what's quite exciting is that this shape distortion of these nuclei have recently, there's strong evidence now from the Isolde facility at CERN for, in fact, the pear-shaped nature of these nuclei, which would then enhance the EDM. So the theoretical work predicted the octopole deformation. The octopole deformation's been seen. Project X can make a lot of these and advance the sensitivity of EDM research for atoms worldwide. What is Project X? So Project X is the evolution of the existing Fermilab accelerator complex with the revolution in superconducting RF technology. You may not have noticed, and I wouldn't expect you would have, but in the last 20 years there's been a revolution in superconducting RF technology, which has enabled laboratories to use that technology as a core for their future machines, such as Jefferson Laboratory and the Spallation Neutron Source rely critically on that technology. 20 years ago, nobody would have done that because it was unstable technology. Again, Dyson's message about how technology drives the field forward. There's a very strong collaboration across the U.S., the laboratories in the U.S. that are advancing Project X. There's a quite important bilateral collaboration between the Project X accelerator team in India, which India has great interest in the particle physics applications of Project X, but also Project X has important energy applications. That technology can have important energy applications. Here's the research program for Project X in a nutshell. Neutrinos, rare processes, platform for a neutrino factory or muon collider. And importantly, I want to mention here is strong synergy in material science and nuclear energy applications, that this facility can be a source of muon spin resonance beam to advanced material science. So beam power is the gateway to the intensity frontier. The reason why we're pursuing this technology, it's not because it's simple, and it's not because it's cheap, because it's neither. It's complicated and it's expensive. But it is the only path forward, and it's worldwide recognized as the only path forward to advance the intensity frontier through high power. What's plotted here is the beam energy of the proton facility versus the current, and in that space, diagonal lines are power. The currency in this game is power, and all those new facilities that are being built into the future have adopted this technology to move forward because it is simply the most efficient mechanism to transfer electric field to a beam, to a proton beam. That's been recognized by the International Linear Collider. The technology of Project X has benefited greatly from the development of the ILC, the 1.3 gigahertz cavities in the ILC. In fact, the last half of Project X, the beta equals one section, of course, where protons look like electrons, is essentially ILC technology. So the evolution of the energy frontier at Fermilab is as follows. We take our antiproton source, which is in the backyard of Fermilab, turn it into a muon campus where we'll pursue the G-2 and mu-de experiments in the near term, and then evolve Project X in three stages, in all likelihood three separate superconducting LINACs, which have the following sensitivity. And there's no time to talk about the elements of this table, but I do want to illustrate as a function of stage in the Project X campaign. You can see the power of the Fermilab campus growing from 700 kilowatts to more than 10 megawatts in its full realization. So the summary, last slide. So the U.S. intensity frontier has a proposed framework and a texture to deliver the science. LB&E and Project X are the proposed framework. It follows from the recommendations of P5. Given the projected funding environment that we live in, the framework must be strong enough to test to stand the test of time. This is the tough question for intensity frontier science. Can that framework stand the test of time? How much time do we have? Well, we need to know how much time we have, and we need to think about other projects, other major projects. So the LHC R&D started in the mid-80s. That was 30 years ago. And that research program has been regarded as a smashing success, and it has been. But it's 30 years. That is the time scale. Decades are the time scale for major facilities. We have to get used to that. And the key question for the intensity frontier and this plan is whether a upgradable high-intensity proton facility will stand the test of time of decades, and whether LB&E and through its stages will stand the test of time. Federation. A problem of the intensity frontier experiments is that they have not realized the vision of the LHC experiments, and in that thousands of researchers working together toward a common goal. These are small, unfederated experiments that would benefit greatly by having the theorists and experimenters work together to talk about joint sensitivity. Resources, as I mentioned, this particular frontier spans several agencies, and we have a challenge to our community to reach out to those agencies, nuclear physics, NSF nuclear physics, NIST, BS, et cetera, to communicate how this research frontier advances both particle physics and the interests of other communities. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. We have time for some questions.
So if I understood your slides, some of the main motivation for the mu to E and LB&E is to measure the neutrino mass and the hierarchy, right?
For LB&E, yes.
But coming from an astrophysics and from a CMB point of view, ACT Pole, which, for example, Steve Ritz mentioned before, through CMB lensing is going to already cover this science in 2 to 3 years. And, you know, CMB lensing is relatively clean and robust, et cetera. So how does that factor in to this, since that's a, you know, quick, cheap experiment that already has funding? And if they do measure the neutrino mass, I mean, they're projected to go to like 0.05 eV at one sigma, then what does it mean for the science case of these experiments?
Thank you for the question. So I wasn't as clear as I should have been, which I apologize for. The LBNE experiment, the leading scientific goal is to discover CP violation in neutrinos. And it has it also has a goal of the mass hierarchy, as you say, but the leading scientific goal is to discover CP violation in neutrinos, which I believe is really the only place that we can make that measurement, is in neutrino oscillation experiments. In the case of the mu to e experiment, and I apologize for being telegraphic. It's clear that I've been too telegraphic here. The goal of the mu to e experiment to search for the muon to electron coherent conversion is to be sensitive to new physics beyond a standard model, SUSY loops, for example, that can contribute dipole terms above the anticipated rate. The anticipated rate is model dependent, but it's very, very, very low from the standard model. So the window of mu to e is to be sensitive to BSM physics at very high mass scales. Now, with respect to the question of connections to the cosmic frontier, it would be wonderful to have an inference of the neutrino hierarchy from cosmology, and then to test that with the NOVA experiment, to have a direct test. That's what our field is about in the end. I mean, who cares what the hierarchy is? Well, what we care about is consistency of the picture in the model. And so the example that you just gave of testing from both sides is really what we're after.
One more question. I'll raise you.
So concerning your last bullet point in terms of the interface between different fields of physics, is there a kind of a concrete plan for that? I asked the same question at Argonne, and I didn't get really an answer.
There are discussions. So there's regular discussion between the Office of High Energy Physics and the Office of Nuclear Physics. They recognize that they have a boundary. And so, you know, in a bureaucratic sense, you have to have boundaries. This is an artifact. The important thing is to have communication. So I think it's recognized in both offices that communication, in particular in the context of particle physics, is important. Now, one thing I'd like to mention is that language screws us up a lot. And so if we describe our field as high energy physics, then we get hung up on a particular tool. And so that leads to contributing to some of these boundaries. You know, I would like us to promote our field as particle physics, to describe it as particle physics, and that helps us with this communication across agencies.
Let's thank Bob one more time for not mentioning Woodstock. No, Woodstock.